From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Peter Biello, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. This week, Black Lives Matter held protests against racial injustice and vigils in memory of those who lost their lives. And after more than 2 months of roped-off parking and patrolled sand, New Hampshire's beaches reopened this week, and lawmakers look to make it easier to vote by absentee ballot. These and other stories we're covering, we're going to recap them in this hour. If you have questions or comments, send us an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Post on our Facebook page at NHPR Exchange or join the conversation live on the air. The number to call is 1-800-892-6477. And joining us for this part of the program, we've got NHPR reporter Sarah Gibson and NHPR's digital engagement producer Dan Tuohy. Thank you for being on the program today.
Thank you.
So I'll start with you, Dan Tuohy, about the protests that took place last night in Portsmouth. You reported on these, as did Todd Bookman, who was there to observe and speak with participants like this one.
My name is Jackie Getz, and I live right here in Portsmouth. You know, being a black person in this community, always watching my back is can be painful. So, but I feel a lot of love tonight. You know, I'm still nervous, but it's great to see the love and support from so many people.
So Dan, I want to get your impression of what took place in Portsmouth last night. Police say about 1,100 people showed up. What was it like from your perspective?
It was quite a crowd. They had the Market Square closed off like they do a few times a year for major events and Market Square days. Speakers, Peter, talked about their personal experiences with police, local and regional police. And talking about, of course, George Floyd and the need for racial justice and really moving this conversation along, not just having a vigil for George Floyd, but talking about accountability, transparency, and encouraging people to get involved and to stay involved in their community, whether it's running for office or attending police commission meetings or even running for the police commission.
Mm-hmm. And so much attention has been on police practices in this past couple of weeks. What was the police presence like in Portsmouth surrounding this protest?
It was notable. Police Chief Bob Murner walked along with the marchers as they walked along a closed-off section of the downtown Portsmouth. There was a police drone overhead, but pretty standard. I think by 9:15... the police presence was cleared out of downtown Portsmouth, and there were very, very few people left in Market Square, just some friends chatting. Very unusual time of year for Portsmouth, as you know. I mean, it's this time of year, typically 9 o'clock at night in Portsmouth, with good weather, would be mobbed with restaurant goers and everything else. It's just a very surreal scene throughout the day.
Yeah, the age of COVID-19 as well has made this a strange time indeed. Dan, were there any arrests or acts of vandalism that we should be aware of as a result of last night's protests?
None that we're aware of. Again, the police presence was notable, but and I should note, too, I was standing back from along the march route, Peter, taking photographs, and I was near a few police officers, and a lot of these attendees were also the speakers were critical of police nationwide in America and locally. And a lot of these marchers did give a shout out to officers along the route saying, you know, thanking them for their service and whatnot.
Mm-hmm. And NHPR Sarah Gibson, I want to turn to you because you covered protests in Manchester earlier in the week. How many people attended, in your estimation, and what took place at those, I believe they were Black Lives Matter organized protests?
Let's see. Yeah, there have been two pretty significant events organized by the Manchester chapter of Black Lives Matter. There was one on Saturday, which my colleague Jason Moon covered, and an estimated close to 1,000 people, folks were saying, who marched down in downtown Manchester. And then there was a vigil, which was kind of thought of more as a kind of quieter, more solemn event that was not a march but was at Stark Park in Manchester on Tuesday night. And it's estimated 700 or so people there. That's the Manchester Police Department estimate. But the park, which is really substantial, was was full of people. So both have been very well attended, significant events that were organized by young people of color, many of whom grew up in Manchester.
And what was the message that Black Lives Matter wanted folks to take away from these events?
Well, they had a couple different messages. You know, one was really just raising up the names and experiences of people who have either died at the hands of police across the country over the last couple of years, but also the experiences that they themselves have had and others in New Hampshire fearing for their lives and also experiencing various kinds of and levels of racism throughout their daily lives. And so there was a real request that people, white allies, do their own work to figure out what it would look like to address racial injustice here in New Hampshire.
And do their own work. I'm sorry to interrupt. Do their own work, meaning like reflect or actually like make some kind of social change,
reflect,
vote in a certain way.
There has been a call to action. And so at least one of the organizers, Ronelle Chayla, has really ended both events saying, look, one of the things we need to think about is voting. And there's been a call for that kind of civic engagement. And she, in fact, said, I've been asked by many people, white people who want to be allies, to ask, how can I help? And one of the ways you can help is to think about these issues and to remember, she said, your Black brothers and sisters when you're at the polls. And I believe we have some tape of her actually on Tuesday at the end of the vigil speaking to people about this issue of voting.
Call the office of your representatives. Make them hear you and let them know that if they refuse to answer our calls to justice, if they refuse to hear our grievances, and if they refuse to make change, we will vote them out!
Ronelle Chayla speaking, organizer of Black Lives Matter on Tuesday night. Sarah, did she or anybody else at Black Lives Matter make any specific demands of either police or lawmakers?
Yeah, that's a good question. So as of now, in my conversations and publicly, the BLM organizers have said we're being pretty slow and methodical about making very direct and explicit asks, either of law enforcement or of the mayor or of, you know, our political leaders. And they're actually coordinating and having some of those conversations with the NAACP. So there are not any explicit asks yet about, you know, reforms that we would maybe see among law enforcement or, you know, law changes that we would see taken up in Concord. But I think some of those requests in conjunction with the NAACP are forthcoming.
Mm-hmm. So I'll ask you the same policing question that I asked Dan Toohey a few minutes ago. What was the police presence like? What happened? And were there any arrests made? Anything we should know about that?
So on Tuesday, you know, there had been, as we reported on Tuesday morning, there was an arrest of a 19-year-old in Manchester who allegedly was kind of threatening riot or damage to police cars on South Willow Street. So that person was arrested and does not, at least according to what we know, is not at all affiliated with the organizing. But there were various posts on social media suggesting there might be some kind of unrest on Tuesday night. So there was a very significant presence of National Guard, of state police, as well as Manchester Police Department throughout the city. And at the vigil itself, there were certainly a number of police cars and police on the sidelines. The vigil was peaceful. It was a somber occasion where, you know, the final words of people who had been killed by police were read aloud, and there were moments of silence. And then the organizers at the end of the event were very, very clear. They said, we need to disband right now. This has been a peaceful event. Thank you for coming, and please go directly home because we want to ensure that from start to finish, this event is peaceful. And so So people left without incident. There were no arrests at the vigil. The police left. And then our understanding is that there were 10 arrests, I believe, of adults and a couple of juveniles over on South Willow Street across from town. And those some of that unrest had already, fireworks being thrown into the road, some other encounters with police officers. Those I've heard were actually happening before the vigil even ended, and then they escalated. And the organizers of the vigil say there was no affiliation. It was a completely different group of people. And in fact, the press release from the Manchester Police Department the next day made it pretty clear the vigil was peaceful, and then there was a separate event with other people across town.
We're speaking with reporters who have some experience covering protests today. And listeners, this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup, and we are dissecting what feels like a month's worth of news that took place in the past week. Heavy stories of pain, protest, and police conduct. All of this is happening with COVID-19 in the background. What do you make of the protests? Give us a call. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can also send an email. The address is exchange@nhpr.org. Dan Tui, I want to turn back to you for a moment about the government's response, particularly Governor Chris Sununu. What has he said about the protests?
Peter, he's been adamant, really, that he supports these peaceful protests. And he, as you may know, the president has said governors need to be tougher on protests. And naturally, New Hampshire, with 1.34 million people, is a little bit different than Minneapolis or New York or D.C. or L.A. But the governor has been emphatic, really, saying that this is something that needs to be addressed. And he pushed back on the president saying, you know, the president said, you know, governor should dominate, quote unquote, these protesters and whatnot.
What was the nature of the pushback? Did he say anything? What specifically, did he disavow it, or did he? What was the language? Do you remember?
Sure. The governor said, you know, quote, I don't think anyone needs to be dominated. If anything, here in New Hampshire, I think we've shown working together in a very peaceful and constructive way is the way to success. And you've seen that. I think you said that in Portsmouth as well. I mean, I think one ingredient to a peaceful protest last night was the chief of police, Bob Murner. He had a commentary earlier in the week that was just very much of an outreach in expressing not solidarity, but understanding that change is perhaps needed in policing in America.
Mm-hmm. Since journalists have been a focus during all of this, I wanted to ask both of you what precautions you're taking to keep yourselves safe while you are covering events like this. I'll start with you, Dan.
Step one is just confirming and communicating with the news director and the digital director. And in this case in Portsmouth last night, Todd Bookman was the reporter, and confer with him and, you know, get an idea of logistics and where we are and kind of get an idea of where we're going to go. Know your surroundings, of course. Naturally, given the COVID-19 pandemic, we were wearing face masks. I know that's been an issue for a lot of people saying, wait a minute, isn't this against the governor's stay-at-home policy? So that's one issue that's really kind of trying to maintain social distancing whenever and wherever possible. In a crowd of 1,000 people, as you might imagine, that's difficult.
Were people spread out as much as possible, or were some people kind of uncomfortably close?
I wouldn't say uncomfortably close, but they were certainly packed in on Pleasant Street in Portsmouth.
Mm-hmm. And what about your experience, Sarah? How are you staying safe out there?
Well, the station has boom mics, which basically extend the microphone so that we're not, you know, just a couple feet away from someone as we interview them. So that has allowed us to use social distancing. And of course, you know, a march and a protest are a little different than a demonstration in place or a vigil in which people aren't moving. So if people are in place, maybe with their heads bowed, with their candle, like on, you know, on Tuesday at the vigil, that's a different scenario for a reporter to move around as other people are in place, and that allows us to ensure more easily that we're maintaining social distance with people and that people are, when we interview them as far away as they can be with us to be able to get good audio for the radio. And most people I encountered were, nearly everyone I encountered was wearing a face mask, and I, of course, was as well. And we've even been putting saran wrap around our microphones and then disposing of that afterwards. So there are various precautions. We have guidelines both from the station and from NPR. And obviously, there are these two layers of safety for protesters as well as journalists who are covering this, which is there's, the concern about the pandemic and a scary infectious virus that we're still trying to understand in terms of how it spreads. And then, of course, there's the fact that in a lot of other cities, as Dan was saying, there is really intense violence. There are curfews and, reporters and others are encountering tear gas, violence on a nightly basis. So that has not happened here in New Hampshire, but we try to be prepared for all scenarios when we go out and cover an event like this.
Well, NHPR Sarah Gibson, we're glad you're safe, and thank you very much for reporting on this and sharing your insights with us. Really appreciate it.
You're welcome.
Dan Tuohy, if you could stay with us for a little bit, we'll check in on the latest COVID-19 news after a break. But I did want to turn to one more issue before we take that break. One way the state of New Hampshire has attempted to address racial injustice has been bail reform, specifically limiting the detention of people held in jail pre-trial. The goal of bail reform, according to the state attorney general's office, is to address some racial and economic disparities in incarceration rates in the state. For more on this, let's turn to Buzz Scher. He's a law professor at UNH School of Law and an advocate of bail reform. Thank you very much for speaking with me.
My pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk.
Is New Hampshire's current system of bail effectively different for Black people than it is for whites? And if so, how?
The answer is we don't know for sure because we don't collect that kind of data well yet. But it potentially can be different for Black people than Caucasians in New Hampshire. The way most people under our new bail system, the Bail Reform Act, the only way people are held pre-trial is if they're found by clear and convincing evidence to be dangerous. We don't know how many of those who have been found to be dangerous and are being detained without bail are Black and how many are white or a person of color. The problem is it's always been the case that in New Hampshire, as nationally, Black people are stopped by the police or briefly detained by the police more often than whites at a disproportionate level. And Black people are arrested at a disproportionate level compared to whites in New Hampshire and nationally.
And how would you describe the impact of bail reform on African-American communities in New Hampshire and other communities of color in New Hampshire? What was the impact?
I think it's been a positive. It's been a positive impact. There are less people of color being detained in New Hampshire pre-trial than post-bail reform than there were pre-bail reform. It's really that simple.
Which in turn would translate to they are able to maybe keep their job because they are not in jail and having to miss shifts, and therefore there's not that economic consequence of having to be held.
Exactly. And they're able to keep their apartments, they're able to support their families are not broken apart, and those who are left without a place to live after they are incarcerated pre-trial and lose their job, their families get shattered on a regular basis simply by, sometimes it's as little as 3 or 4 days in jail. Somebody can lose their job. So it really has had a significant positive impact in the way you described and the ways I'm describing. It's really made a big difference.
So what more needs to happen with respect to our current bail system to make it more racially fair?
I don't think it's the bail system that needs reform. I think it's the front end that needs reform. The front end being, we know that police detain and arrest Black people far more frequently, disproportionately more frequently than white people. And I think we need, as a society in New Hampshire, to take a look at that feature in the criminal justice system. We don't, you know, if we're sending black people into this system at disproportionate numbers, we need to take a look at the causes of that. And that's a harder issue. It's not an issue about bail. It's an issue about attitudes in terms of police departments and prosecutors. Secondarily, it's a little bit of a bail reform, a bail problem, in that we need to take a close look at what are the reasons, if it's the case, that black people are being found more frequently to be dangerous than white people are and therefore detained without bail.
On the issue of policing, are there, in your view, some unfair or biased police practices that, if changed, would result in fewer arrests, perhaps eliminating the need for a bail decision in the first place?
I wish it were that simple. It's simply a matter of a changing policy. I think it, in terms of police misconduct, policy changes might make a big difference.
Well, Buzz Scherr, thank you very much for speaking with me. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
That's Buzz Scherr, law professor at UNH School of Law. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. We were speaking a little while ago about the protests held by Black Lives Matter and the vigil as well. We get this note from Nancy from Durham, who wrote, "At Durham's vigil last night, the police were prominent participants expressing their dismay and outrage at the police brutality the country has witnessed. It is critical that police speak out in order to mend and strengthen the relationship with the communities they serve." That's the note from Nancy in Durham. And let's talk to Mike in Concord. Mike, thank you very much for calling. You're on the air.
Thank you for having me. I just want to say that, you know, I was at the vigil in Dover. I was at the march last Saturday in Manchester, and I'll be at the march tomorrow in Concord. And I actually felt safer there than I did at the grocery store. There was lots of people there, obviously, but the vast majority of people were masked versus I go through the grocery store and people aren't following the directions of the aisles. People aren't wearing masks. People aren't invading my space. Just kind of pulling through, I find that the types of people that are at the protest are very conscious people who are really, you know, needing to show up, which I find so important, but really trying to do it as safely as they can and really taking all this stuff into account. It's been great.
Well, thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate it. And I will say, too, you know, walk into any given retail establishment, it has been, in my experience, too, a mix of people wearing masks, not wearing masks. How that makes you feel safety-wise is sort of a matter of individual perspective. But Dan Toohey, seems like people were wearing masks. Is that your impression as well, people wearing masks at these things?
Yes, absolutely. You know, you can go to NHPR.org to see Todd Bookman's story, in which Todd and I both have a lot of photographs from the scene, and people were getting creative as well, writing, you know, words on their masks to make a statement, including one woman whose masks had a message about breathe, you know, as in I can't breathe, you know, one of George Floyd's last words.
Well, Dan, hang on with us. We'll talk a little bit more about COVID-19 when we come back. But we're going to break down some big headlines regarding COVID-19. Beaches are open now. We'll talk about what can and can't happen at beaches, especially as the weather is heating up. Your questions and comments are welcome. Call us 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back.
Staying connected is so important right now, and NHPR is committed to being a place where we can all come together to stay informed as a community. I'm Rick Gamley, host of Morning Edition. The trusted news coverage you hear every day on NHPR is made possible because a community of listeners value this essential service enough to pitch in. Please join them as an NHPR sustaining member for just $10 a month. It's quick and easy at nhpr.org.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. On Monday on The Exchange, we talked to restaurant owners in the Granite State about how they have fared during the pandemic and challenges that now that outdoor dining is permitted. Right now, we're talking about how the beaches are reopening. Forecast is going to be really hot today, hot weekend as well. But we also want to give you an update on the COVID-19 numbers as we have them here in the state. Yesterday, DHHS announced 81 new positive test results for COVID-19. DHHS has also announced 8 additional deaths related to COVID-19. All of those 8 people were over the age of 60. I'm here with NHPR's Dan Tuohy, digital engagement producer here. Dan, before we get into the details about the beaches and the other kinds of businesses that have opened or taken steps towards reopening in the past week, I wanted to ask you about a note we got from Dave. Dave asks, why do you keep treating age 60 as a bright line threshold? Is that what apples-to-apples data says about risk, or do lives not matter quite so much after 60? What do you think, Dan? I mean, that's the kind of line that the state gives us, right? That these people are over the age of 60, yes?
It is indeed. Yeah, it's 60 and older is the demographic that the state outlines in terms of a population being more at risk than obviously anyone under 60. And I know for us that are a little bit older than millennials, you realize that, well, 60 is not that old, right? But that's their category, not just for people in long-term care facilities and nursing homes, but older Americans who may be more susceptible to this virus.
But not as Dave says, that lives don't matter quite so much after 60. That's not what that's about.
Not at all. And, you know, nursing homes, as you know, Peter, have really been socked by this virus.
Yeah. We learned this week that close to 80% of the deaths related to COVID-19 in New Hampshire have been residents of long-term care facilities, congregate living environments. On that subject, Dan, Wade wrote to us to ask, why are we the worst? Does the state's institutions have an inadequate set of policies and procedures, or lack of oversight, or not enough planning or practice drills? So Wade's referring to the New Hampshire's relatively high number of percentage of those who died coming from long-term care facilities, congregate living environments. First of all, are we the worst? Do you know if we're the worst?
No, I don't think we are. And the state and the health commissioner, Lori Chibonette, has mentioned this. That I think every news conference she mentions, I wouldn't say pushing back because that sounds like she's being defensive, but we in the press talk about this 80% figure for the deaths in New Hampshire being from nursing homes and long-term care facilities. And she points out that, you know, and as a percentage of long-term care centers, New Hampshire is really behind or better, quote unquote, than Mass, New York, Rhode Island. The deaths, Peter, as a percentage of beds available, New Hampshire's at 1.5%, Massachusetts is at 6.9%, and Rhode Island's at 8.29%. And those are numbers that the governor himself mentioned earlier this week in his presentation.
Yeah, but has the state given any kind of explanation as to why long-term care facilities are taking the disproportionate hit?
Not in as much as they are an at-risk population, and you know the testing. That, you know, I guess every nursing home at this point has been tested at least once, and that's going on. And Josh Rogers had a story for us this week as well about this legislation moving forward that the state will study the impact on nursing homes with COVID-19, and some of these questions that we don't really have answers to, such as what is the infectious control policies at nursing homes? What's the staffing level? And really taking a closer look at this. And we'll have, I think, mountains of data coming out of this over the next year.
Listeners, we're speaking about the week in COVID-19 news, and we'd love to hear your insights on how the state is reopening, whether it's public places or private businesses, how this is proceeding from your perspective. We'd love to hear it. The number is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR, or email exchange at nhpr.org. Let's talk about the beaches, Dan, because it's warming up out there. The weather has been great for the beach. As of Monday, we were allowed to do a few things on the beach, and then today there were some changes, I believe. Where do things stand now? What can we do on the beach?
Yes, there's some breaking news on the beach front, the beach beat.
The governor mentioned today, Peter, that he's reopening or revising that order. So traditional beach activities such as sunbathing and lounging and sports can continue effective immediately. Since June 1, that was part of the order was to limit or prohibit lounging, sitting. It was only for active recreation, so running, swimming, surfing. And the governor all along is anticipated when warmer weather comes that it's going to be very difficult to keep people off beaches. And as you mentioned, it's going to be a hot day today. People are already out in the beach and surfers, of course, all week long. And we'll see what happens. It is interesting to note that state parking lots, state parks over here, they have like a 50% limit of capacity. And there's no parking on Route 1A, also known as Ocean Boulevard. So parking, it will be very limited and difficult for a lot of people that want to visit the beach. And of course, towns can adjust their own town parking lot occupancy. But there's also continues to be a larger police presence along the seacoast. We'll see how that continues as the warmer weather arrives here this weekend.
Mm-hmm. And does that also apply to state parks, freshwater lakes?
Yes, I mean, the inland parks and beaches were treated a little bit differently, really from the get-go, in part because of Massachusetts and Maine being part of this intercoastal Gulf of Maine usage. And granted, the governor's mentioned this off and on and again, that we're very close to Massachusetts, which is dealing with a much worse case with COVID-19. So he's also trying to open or reopen the beaches in concert with Mass and Maine. And I think we're just a little bit behind them. But now that June is here, you hear a lot of restaurant owners and businesses that depend on summer businesses feeling a little bit of relief.
And what other things opened this week, Dan? What types of businesses took a step toward getting back to normal?
Well, today, June 5th, is the day for hotels and lodging and short-term rentals to reopen with, again, social distancing guidance and for certain larger hotels, occupancy limitations, Peter. The governor's, I believe, will have a news conference today, again, at 3 p.m. That hasn't yet been announced, but we're expecting that. And there's plenty of businesses that really are looking for guidance for reopening. And the governor hears time and again about people who had weddings this year. They want to have some guidance and know what they can and cannot do. There are people and wedding planners and businesses in that industry that are, their livelihoods are at stake. And we may also today hear from adult daycare businesses, whether they get guidance for reopening. Also, maybe whether there's any new restaurant guidance, such as whether restaurants can have limited indoor seating, not just the outdoor dining that's you see popping up statewide.
And HPR is
a whole other issues.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. No, I mean, there's a whole other issues and sectors that a task force is looking into and getting feedback from businesses and stakeholders and whatnot. I mean, it's pretty amazing when you talk about little things you never think about, like running races, road races. John from Millennium Running had a presentation last month talking about, mass starts for road races won't happen anytime soon, but maybe they can have like a time trial start or staggered starts. So that's just another example of some of the smaller but very important to a lot of people events that some of this information and new guidance will be coming out at some point.
Yeah, we'll keep an eye on that, and especially news to come at the governor's press conference today at 3 o'clock. NHPR's Dan Tuohy, thank you very much for giving us the update. Really appreciate it.
Great, thank you.
Listeners, we're always in favor of hearing your thoughts about the week's news, whether it's related to COVID-19 or the protests that we've been hearing about. Give us a call, 1-800-892-6477. I want to turn now to a bit of legislative news. A state Senate committee backed a bill yesterday that would allow voters in New Hampshire to register online to vote starting next year. The bill would also make it easier to vote absentee. Democrats were in favor of the proposal. Republicans opposed. State Senator Melanie Levesque, chair of the Election Law Committee, is with me now to discuss this bill. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you for having me.
New Hampshire is among the minority of states that require an excuse of some kind to vote absentee. This year, COVID-19 has given anyone who wants to vote absentee a valid excuse. So why then is it important to pass this bill now?
Well, we have always felt that we should put into law the absentee, no excuse absentee ballot. There are many different excuses, and if we could put in no excuse, or if we had no excuse absentee, we wouldn't need an executive order or an advisory from our attorney generals. We would just have the ability to choose to do an absentee ballot.
Mm-hmm. Some prominent politicians say voting by absentee ballot increases the likelihood of voter fraud. What can you say to those who worry about that in this case?
Well, I think that there are checks within the system that prevent that. We have very little voter fraud. We need to look out for the needs of our people, and we have a constitutional right to vote, and we should be able to determine how we vote, whether it be at the polls or absentee. It just so happens that this year it is more critical to have people vote absentee because it may not be as safe at the polls because of COVID.
Mm-hmm. You'd like to see that in place. Yeah. So you mentioned that there are some checks that would prevent the likelihood of a fraud occurring. Which of those checks do you think are the most significant or give you the most comfort?
Well, I think the fact that people have a driver's license that is used as one of the identifications, the driver's license has already been vetted by the DMV. So the bulk of those requests are going to be with some kind of valid validated ID. There will be others that may need some kind of affidavit, but we'll deal with those as well.
The bill would also allow for online voter registration. Why is it important for people to be able to register online?
Well, if we had online voter registration at this time, we wouldn't have to be concerned about getting to the city clerk or town clerk. And during this time of COVID, the office hours are limited. We could just register online. That also goes for changing your address. If you want to change your address, it's almost like re-registering. If we had the ability, like many states, to go online and change that address or register online, it would save a lot of people going to the polls. When I went last year to the polls with my daughter, there were five lines that were five people deep, and what she wanted to do was change her address. She asked if she could do that online. We don't have that capability, but I think we need that capability.
Are we among the minority of states that do not have the capability, or is this something most states don't have?
Well, many states have it. I would say that we're close to a minority. There are more and more states that are adopting these reforms. The states around us, Vermont and Rhode Island and Connecticut, have similar products, as well as Maine and Massachusetts.
So if people are able to register to vote online, in your view, is the logical conclusion there that more people will be registered to vote and then more people will actually take advantage of that right and vote?
Well, I believe that it will make it easier for people to get into the voting process. I think we'll see more people. I also believe that not all elections are the same. There may not be as much excitement to go out to an election. I think this is a big year. I think there's going to be a lot of people voting. Granted, it won't be in place this year, but we hear many times that the voting participation goes down. And I really think that depends on the election. Mm-hmm. I see this as making it more accessible for people to register to vote and be in that process.
One part of this bill that did get some level of bipartisan support was the provision that allowed pre-processing of absentee ballots. What does that refer to and why is that important?
Well, we are going to be flooded with absentee ballots. And in New Hampshire, we do count the ballots on election day and we see the results on election day. So to be able to prepare the ballots and get them ready to be counted, not to view them, but that will help save time as we actually count the ballots on election day. Now, even before COVID, this has been a request by some of our larger cities. And the Secretary of State has expressed a agreement of some sort to move forward with something like this.
Mm-hmm. So what's next for this bill?
Well, next we will hear it in the Senate, and we will vote on that, and then we will bring it to the governor.
State Senator Melanie Levesque, thank you very much for being on the program today. Really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Peter Biello. Still to come, we're going to speak with Mayor of Nashua, Jim Donches, about how his city is faring during the COVID-19 pandemic. Check in with a few policies that he and the city have put in place. You can express your questions or comments about anything related to the week's news or specific to Nashua if you'd like. The number is 1-800-892-6477. 1-800-892-NHPR or email exchange@nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. We'll be right back. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange on NHPR. I'm Peter Biello. Give us a call if you've got questions or comments about the week's news. 1-800-892-6477 or email exchange@nhpr.org. And we turn now to Jim Donches, Mayor of Nashua, for a look at how Nashua is proceeding at this point in the pandemic. Welcome, Mayor Donches.
Well, thank you for having me on.
So the city's Board of Aldermen approved an emergency public health order requiring face coverings in certain public spaces to help combat the spread of the virus. But what prompted this ordinance by the city council?
Well, first, we're using a fact-based approach, science, and I think that's what people want. And what people need, of course, is health and safety and security. And this ordinance helps to deliver that.
Mm-hmm.
And science shows that that masks really are very effective in preventing the spread of the COVID-19, especially if worn by both sides. And we're trying to protect not only the people who wear the masks, but their family members, their neighbors, their friends. And we know that this ordinance will help us do that.
So,
of course, we're also interested, and some people have expressed this, in people deserve personal freedom. So we are taking an approach towards enforcement that really is encouragement, and encouragement as opposed to any kind of arrests or anything. We've worked with the police department, and when they receive notice that people in areas where masks should be worn are not wearing them, the police are prepared to approach and counsel them that they should be wearing a mask. So we think we've reached a good balance between people's safety and security and people's personal freedom at the same time.
Mm-hmm. And how have the public at large and business owners in particular responded to this ordinance? Are they in support of it?
I think it's been positive. I mean, this is not this whole COVID-19 pandemic. I mean, it's hard for everyone.
Mm-hmm. And are there exceptions to this mask rule? Does everybody have to wear it at all times when they're like walking down the sidewalk, or are there exceptions?
There are only certain areas where they need to wear it. First of all, indoors, in public spaces, a store, a mall, things like that,
mm-hmm.
or in a gathering place outside. But if you're just walking down the street or by yourself, or you don't need the mask. Now, there are also exceptions for people whose health might be negatively affected by wearing a mask. For example, if someone has asthma and the mask would impair their breathing, then there's no necessity for them to wear the mask. But we are trying to get as much voluntary compliance as we possibly can to protect our citizens and our people from and try to contain the virus.
There's a protest planned for tomorrow night at Greeley Park. Is there potential there for escalation of mask violation if people aren't wearing masks?
Well, there's going to be a rally vigil regarding the murder of George Floyd, and the organizers, which include NAACP, Organization of Black Unity, and the Black Lives Matter, are making it clear that they want the proper social distancing. They're going to have masks available for anybody who does not have them. So we think we can operate in a way that is maximizes safety while at the same time expressing our sympathy for the many people in our community and around the country, especially people in the African American community that are really in pain and deserve to know that people stand with them.
Mm-hmm. Regarding this public health order around masks, what would be your benchmark for retracting this order?
Well, we're going to use a fact-based scientific approach. And as once the disease declines, then to a point where it seems that the masks aren't necessary, then we will, of course, rescind the ordinance.
I want to ask a hospital question because you've got two hospital facilities in town, Southern New Hampshire Medical Center and St. Joseph Hospital. How are things going with these hospitals? Do they have everything they need to treat COVID-19 patients in Nashua?
Yes, definitely. We have a call three times a week. It was daily for a while. Three times a week with the hospitals right now. There was one just an hour or so ago. They're doing well. I mean, because of all the measures that have been taken across the state to keep people safe, the stay-at-home orders and the social distancing, they never experienced a surge that was beyond their capacity. So right now, the two hospitals together have 11 or 12 COVID-19 patients. The peak was near 20, 18, 19, around in there. And it varies day by day, but their capacity to handle people, to treat people, is much higher than that. So we have successfully, as they say, lowered the curve, and the hospitals never became overwhelmed.
Mayor Jim Donchus, Mayor of Nashua, thank you very much for joining us. Really appreciate it.
Thank you.
This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on The Exchange, and the coronavirus pandemic has changed the way many of us do our jobs, including many of us here at NHPR. Our reporters haven't been able to get out and record your voices as much as we would like to. So what we've done is we've asked people to step in for us to record their own lives and share how daily life has been interrupted in big and small ways. And today we bring you the story of Anna Grazier, a woman who is trying to excel at two things she loves, raising her sons and running a chocolate business.
That's enough shower. Coffee's ready. My name is Anna Grazier. I live with my husband, Matt, and our two teenage sons. They're 14 and 16 years old, and I am a chocolate maker. We have spent the last 2 months of the pandemic actually building a new chocolate factory. For us, we've invested everything we have and then some into this chocolate business. And we can't afford to take 2 months off because it's not like we can go back to a job that's still there.
By the end of the day today when we're accounted for it, okay?
Okay. I just sent money for the cabinet plan. Oh my gosh, streaker. The remote learning has been a struggle for all of us. And it's been... Well, it's been hard for both of my sons to manage the tasks and the overwhelm, the schedule. There is no routine.
Do you know what you have to do for science?
Yeah.
What?
I spend a couple hours a week at the beginning and at the end of the week, generally, with the boys. One of our sons has ADD, and he's very intelligent, very, very smart kid, but he needs support.
So 12 plus 12 would be 24 times 17, or 17 plus 17 is 34 times 12. They both should equal 204 square centimeters, right? Is this the math that was due earlier this week?
I don't know. I'm just doing whatever it says.
It's okay. You're off to a great start now that you've figured out this problem. Okay? So.
I'm just freaking out.
Don't freak out. One question at a time. Okay? One question at a time.
Everyone else knows how to manage this stuff. It makes no sense to me.
You mean they know how to manage the time or the assignments?
Schoolwork. Yeah, they know. It doesn't make any sense to me.
Oh, sweetie.
If you look at my grades, even you can tell. The second I got out of school and I'm stuck at home, everything just went down and nothing works anymore. Quarantine ruined my high school already.
It's 1 year out of high school.
Oh God, I feel totally inadequate as a parent. I know that I'm capable of doing home-based learning, and I could have a lot of fun with it if I had the time and the resources to not have, you know, financial worries and concerns. But I don't, and it doesn't feel fair to my kids. I am worried about my kids paying for everything. Everything. Maybe if things stay shut down for a month and if more people lose jobs, they are not going to buy something as luxurious as a fine bar of chocolate.
So it's Tuesday, April 21st at 7:12. P.M. I just ordered pizza for dinner. Didn't want to, but it is what it is. Boys and I ate half, and now I'm taking the other half to Matt, who is at the new shop putting the first coat of beautiful final paint on the walls. So I can't wait to see it. Pizza? Oh, it's going to be dark.
Yeah, but you'll be surprised. You gotta wait till we get the flooring.
I know, the bright floor, all the silver.
The bright floor and the bright ceiling and all the machines, it's gonna disappear.
It's gonna look nice.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
No. Building a chocolate factory at all is kind of a crazy idea during any time. Who builds a chocolate factory? And then to build it or rebuild it during a time when we're already feeling like we've lost our footing because of the pandemic, nobody knows what it's gonna look like.
You gonna hang out with me?
No, Will needs some attention. I have to go home and help him map out his schoolwork for tomorrow.
Poor kid.
He was bummed that I was even leaving to bring you pizza.
Oh, he is struggling.
Yeah. He wants family time.
Oh, I know.
I asked this morning, he and I planned to go on a walk when I got home from work, but it was pouring rain.
I told him, I said, I can't do anything till the factory gets set up in here next week. I said, we got another week to go, and then we can take time.
I do think what I'm doing is worth it because it's an amazing business, and it feels a little bit selfish, but at the same time, if I'm not happy, I don't know how I can bring happiness to our family.
Well, it's turned a little waste into something useful. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's easy to clean if we for some reason get chocolate on the ceiling.
Oh gosh, that'll never happen.
I feel like it will somehow.
So I'm hoping that you guys come in here and learn how to make really good coffees, and then you guys can have a part-time job.
I'll teach you how to use the espresso machine so you can make your mocha.
You can run the bar. Mm. Wouldn't that be a cool job?
Making chocolate, this endeavor, it gives me a kind of fulfillment that I've not felt before with other work endeavors. I think I'm doing what I should be doing. I hope my kids discover that sooner than I did. I hope that maybe with all of the struggle that they've experienced and also witnessed during these past months and this larger period in our country, I hope that if anything, that helps them understand what's important to them and what they want to contribute.
Okay, back to homework.
Yeah.
Homework. Right. Homework. Focus.
I'm gonna do Japanese.
Okay, what about science? I know you don't feel like watching this 2.5 hour movie.
I'm just gonna Google the answers because I got no reason to sit through a 2.5 hour movie when I can do it in 20 minutes.
At least let the movie run in the background while you Google.
Sounds good.
That was Anna Grazier and her family in Exeter, and this story was produced by NHPR's Sarah Gibson. And this has been the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Thank you so much for tuning in. Thanks so much to the guests who brought us insights today. Our show's producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Senior producer is Ellen Grimm. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Michael Brindley is our program manager. And Jane Vaughn is production fellow for The Exchange. Our regular theme music was composed by Bob Lord. Remember, the conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. I'm Peter Biello. Thank you very much for listening, and have a great weekend.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.